We have been looking at Matthew chapter 10. If you want to turn there, we'll finish that chapter tonight. Of course, we broke up the first few verses that listed the apostles and looked at each of those apostles in a little more detail. With some of them, a little more was all there was. They're barely mentioned outside of that verse or verses there at the beginning of Matthew 10. Others, there's quite a bit about, but we looked at that, and we studied that a little bit. And then we looked at the first part of what is often referred to as the limited commission. And of course, we talked about why it was called limited. It was limited in who they preached to, and what the message they preached, and how long a period of time they preached that, and some of those things. And so it certainly had its limitations. And you might have wondered, well, why did we stop in the middle of it when there's all this other that Jesus continues to say? The main reason that we stopped where we did was because those things in the first part, up to verse 23, where we stopped last time, tended to have some things that were specific to the apostles and specific to that little missionary effort that they were making at that time. And certainly some things that wouldn't apply to us today. Now, there were a few things in there that are timeless principles that would still apply to us. But much of what was in that first part was specific instructions to them as they were going out preaching on that trip. And so we stopped then at verse 23 because beginning in verse 24, the things in this section toward the end of the chapter are much more applicable to us today. They're much more the kind of things that are eternal principles that are going to be true no matter what. And so we want to look at some of those things. We see in verse 24, as we start that section, the disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. There is an order to things. There is a hierarchy always. In every organization, in every thing that you run across, somebody's got to be over somebody else or else you have total chaos. And if we go against the natural order of things, we're going to have problems. Students have to be under the teacher. The disciple has to be under the master. If you have the disciple trying to teach the master, you run into some trouble sometimes with that. If you have the servant trying to tell the Lord how things ought to be done, you have some problems with that. It doesn't work well that way. So these things are set in a certain way. And Jesus makes it clear, of course, in this section, He's the Lord and Master. And the apostles, the disciples, even us today, we're the servants. We're the disciples today of Jesus Christ. And so it's a problem anytime we try to put ourselves above Jesus. That's going to bring trouble. That's going to bring problems. When we put ourselves first instead of putting Jesus first, it's going to be a problem. He goes on to explain in verse 25 that what the disciples' goal is to try to be like the Master. That's the whole reason that we're studying and learning about Jesus. We want to be more like Him. Now, will we ever be exactly like Him? Well, no. We're never going to reach that, and we're certainly never going to be better than Him. But our goal is to be as much like Him as we can, to reach as close to Him as we can possibly reach. And that takes a lot of effort to try to reach up to that standard. And so Jesus also lets them know here then, if the people cursed Him, and He's the Master, then they're going to curse the servants too. If they called the master names, then they're going to call the servants names. So if ever we come upon a time in our lives where we're mistreated by someone out there in the world, we shouldn't be surprised. Jesus has been being mistreated by people for 2,000 years. Why should we be surprised if we're mistreated? If we're laughed at, if we're scorned, if we're called names or various different things. And he mentions particularly Beelzebub, they called him these names, but particularly that one, Beelzebub. And that actually comes from, it actually was a term of derision that the Jews gave to some of the different idols. It meant Lord of the dunghill. It was the Lord of the sewer. And then they turned around and called Jesus that name. And here we are, His disciples. We can expect, well, they're not going to think too highly of us either. And it seems more and more, you know, there was a time when being a Christian was respected in our society, where, you know, everybody was expected to be a Christian, and now it's moving more and more away from that and further toward ridicule and scoffing at those who are Christians. And of course, there are probably some who have gone as far as the Jewish leaders of Jesus' day did in calling names. Not the majority, perhaps, yet, but we may get to that point before long. We certainly have been heading in that direction over the past few years. Then Jesus, in verse 26, helps the disciples to understand that even though these people are doing these things, fearing them is not good. Everything that they do is going to come out in the end. They don't need to be afraid. We don't need to live in fear. We certainly don't need to base our decisions in life on fear. That's not what drives our decision making. If it does, why, before long we'll be like the fellow in Proverbs who would never go out of the house because he's afraid there might be a lion in the streets. So we get to the point we could never leave the house. And some people do. Their fear overwhelms them to the point they can't even leave the house because they're afraid something bad is going to happen. I remember one woman, and I guess now she had brain cancer, so I'm sure that affected her thought process to some degree. But she had gone kind of the other direction. She was afraid to sleep in her house because some of these folks had come and told her that her house was possessed by demons. And so she was trying to sleep in a little gazebo-like thing outside in her yard. And, you know, it just... But they had her convinced that she couldn't sleep in that house because there was demons in there. And so we've got to watch out that we don't allow fear to overcome us. Jesus explains that any secret thing, hidden things, it's not hidden to God. It's going to be revealed. We talked about that this morning in Ecclesiastes, that every secret thing is going to come into judgment. So there's no secrets from God. And really, ultimately, there aren't any real secrets. Secrets, they get found out so many times. But ultimately, of course, God always knows. In verse 27, as we notice this, Jesus has, in the past, told people, you know, don't tell what happened to you. When He healed somebody, He said, you know, keep it quiet, don't say anything. He's said to people, don't tell who I am. But now, at this point, Jesus tells them that it's time to start telling everyone. He says, whatever, if I've whispered it to you in the ear, you shout it from the rooftops. If it's been told you in secret, now it's time to let everybody know. And it was time for them to start getting out there teaching everything that Jesus had been teaching them. And of course, we know that He gave them the power to perform miracles too. So once they started performing these miracles, people were going to notice. And they were going to start saying, how do you have the power to be doing these things? And they're going to have to say, well, you know, we got this power from Jesus. Jesus gave us the power to do this. In verse 28, He comes back to the topic of fear again. How often do we act out of fear? How often is that our motivation? Some may have, we may have initially become a Christian. We may have been baptized because we were afraid, because we were afraid of hell. And so I want to be baptized because I don't want to go there. That's scary. So, and that's why we were baptized. Hopefully, we've grown to continue obeying God for some different reasons other than that. But that may have been the initial thing that got us sparked. But how often in other areas of our lives do we act out of fear? Sometimes we do this with people. We're afraid to condemn sin for fear of being called judgmental or being called a bigot or a hate monger or any of the other names that people will call someone who calls sin, sin. Maybe we are afraid that we'll lose a friend if we let them know what they're doing is not right. And some certainly have lost friends over that. We're afraid to speak out because, well, we might be considered a cult. People start thinking the church is a cult if we speak out about things. They thought the church was in the first century. They considered them a sect, a cult, even. We're afraid to take the gospel to some because we're afraid they might reject us, or maybe we're afraid it might be dangerous to try to teach them the gospel. And we're often afraid, and sometimes we act out of that fear. But let's look at the other side of that coin. How often do we act out of fear for our eternal soul? How often do we act out of a fear of God and what He can do to us? You see, that's the point that Jesus makes here. Jesus points out, if you're going to act out of fear, then you better act out of fearing the right thing. Don't fear man. Man can kill the body, but after that he doesn't have any more power. He can't do anything else. He can't hurt your soul. But God can destroy both body and soul in hell. So you better be afraid of that. You better act to avoid that end. And then he turns it from fear, then he starts to give us another reason why we should act on behalf of God rather than acting because of what other people think or say. He goes on to explain, aren't two sparrows sold for a farthing or a penny, some translations say, just for a little bit? And yet not one of them falls on the ground without your Father knowing about it. Without God knowing it. Not one little bird, not one little lizard, not one little bug for that matter, we might say, falls on the ground and dies without God knowing about it. Even the tiniest of creatures, He knows about it. See, God notices even the smallest, most insignificant of parts of His creation. Well, how much more so then the crowning joy of His creation. Man that He created in His own image. How much more is He going to be concerned with us? And then He goes on in verse 30. He points out the hairs of our head are counted. Have you ever counted the hairs on your head? Now, you stay out of this, Bill. I know you have. But for the rest, have you ever counted the hairs on your head? That would be a time-consuming task. And not only are they counted, but each one of them is numbered. Now, you can't even get a microscope and look and find the number on it. It's not numbered in that way. But you realize, if I reach up here and grab a hair and pluck it out, I don't know which one I've got. I might, you know, is that a gray one or is that a brown one? I don't know. But God knows whether the one I pulled out was number 127 or number 4,983. He knows which number of hair I've, you know, He knows each. Can you imagine that? I think we've eclipsed 7 billion people on this planet. And He knows how many hairs are on the head of every single one of those people. And has them all numbered. Well, the FBI would like to have that kind of ability, wouldn't they? Oh, look, we found a hair at the crime scene. We know which number it is and which head of hair it came out of. They could solve a lot of crimes that way, couldn't they? God knows. He knows everything about us. It's not just our hair. But the point that Jesus is making is that's something that's, you know, we don't spend a lot of time with that. We don't think about that. We couldn't even count that ourselves, and yet God can do it and has done it, and yet it's such an insignificant thing. And then he points out to us, he said this about the birds, and then he said this about our hair, and he says, don't you know that you are more valuable than those little birds to your father? Don't you think he cares more about you than he does a little bird? Well, unfortunately, in our society today, there are some people who don't think so. Some people think birds and deer and cows and everything else is more important than people. But Jesus had it clear. People are more important than the animals. Don't you think you're more valuable to God than a dog or a cat? A bird or a bug? I hope so. You know, sometimes it kind of, some of the song talks about, we sing that song about, for such a worm as I. Some of the song, I don't remember if ours says that. Some of them have changed it to such a one as I. But, you know, well, God doesn't really consider us as a worm. Now, we might think of ourselves that way in the context of that song. I understand what it's saying. But God doesn't put us in the same category with a worm. He didn't send His Son to come and teach the worms. He didn't send His Son to come and die for the worms. But He did send Him to come and teach the people and die for the people. And so we are much more valuable than any other creature in all creation. And then Jesus says, if you're going to speak up for Him here in this life, then He's going to speak up for you before His Father. Now, Brother Kaufman had an interesting thought on this that I hadn't considered before. He thought that this had reference to confession as a part of the conversion process, and that as someone confessed Christ and was buried with Him in baptism, that Jesus at that point confessed them before His Father, and that, of course, that's the point at which our names are written in the Book of Life. Now, that doesn't mean that the name can never be blotted out, but the Bible talks about the fact that that can be blotted out. But he thought that's what it referred to. I don't know that it's just talking about that one thing. I think it's talking about a continual confessing of Jesus with our life. If we're living our life letting people know that we believe in Jesus, and we're acting like we believe in Jesus, and like we know who He is, and we don't back down, and we don't deny it, as he says in the next verse, verse 33. If we deny Him, if we act like we don't know who He is down here, then when we get there, He's going to act like He doesn't know us. And it won't be an act, because we didn't know Him. If we weren't willing to stand up for Him. If we'll deny Him, then He'll deny us. Verse 34, Jesus turns the tables a little further. And he points out here that, interestingly enough, as people often think of Jesus as the Prince of Peace. You know, that's what the angels said the day He was born, or the night He was born. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace and goodwill toward men. But what we don't realize is the peace that Jesus came to bring wasn't peace among men. He didn't promise that. That's not what He came. He brought the opportunity for man to have peace with God, but He didn't necessarily come to bring peace among men. In fact, He says quite the opposite. I came to bring a sword. When we think about a sword, we think about something that's going to cut and divide and injure and harm. He's going to use that sword. He's going to divide. He's going to divide some things, and He begins to talk about that then. You know, we don't think about that with a violent weapon like a sword. And yet, that's what Jesus said He came to bring. He came to divide the righteous from the unrighteous, the godly from the ungodly. He came even to divide families, verse 35 said. You see, we're separated by the sword of His Word. There are those who will obey it, and there are those who won't. Everyone who obeys it makes the cut. Everybody who doesn't gets cut. That's the way it works. We are divided in this world. Not by skin color, not by nationality or ethnicity, Oh, I know people divide over all those things, not by socioeconomic status. That's not what divides. The thing that divides the people of this world is the ones that obey God and the ones who don't. That's the division that we have. And we want to be of those who do obey Him. If we're willing to submit to God, then we're going to be divided. Because we can't in good conscience say and that we're following God, that we're being obedient to Him, and yet continue to live like those in the world. That can't work. That's what we call a hypocrite. We can't have it both ways. We've got to either decide, are we with Him or against Him? We can't straddle the fence. Verse 39. Jesus says, whoever finds his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. You know, in our society today, isn't it amazing how many people are out there trying to find themselves? They're looking for the wrong thing, aren't they? We need to be trying to find Jesus. We need to be trying to find God instead of trying to find ourselves. If we'll find Jesus, then we'll find ourselves. We'll find ourselves in heaven one day, for one thing, if we'll find Jesus and follow Him. But our society today is all about, I'm just trying to find myself. If you manage to find yourself, if you spend all your life trying to find yourself, then you've lost yourself. You've missed the boat. Jesus said, if you try to find yourself, you try to save your life, you try to find your own life, your own way through life, that's the end of it. That's not going to work. Then in verse 40, and it's interesting, some of you may, especially if you have the American Standard Version, verses 40, 41, and 42 are all one verse. It's just 40. Okay, but in the King James, it's 40, 41, and 42, so we'll look at it that way. If we're going to receive God in our lives, the way we do that is by receiving Jesus. And the way we receive Jesus is by receiving those He sent out, His apostles, and by accepting their teachings. We can't reject the apostles and their teachings and reject Jesus and His teaching and then think that we're going to be accepting the Father. That doesn't work. And yet there are many in the world today, I don't want to study the Bible, I don't want to do all that, I don't want to have the church, I don't want to do this, I just want Jesus. Just give me Jesus. Well, you can't have Jesus without His teaching and without the teaching that the apostles did on His behalf after He went back to heaven. You can't have that way. It all goes together. It's all one. Verse 41. You know, not everyone's going to be a prophet, or the King James says righteous man, but it's also like a holy man, not everybody's going to be the preacher. Not everybody's going to be was a prophet in the Old Testament. Not everybody was a priest in the Old Testament. And Jesus brings that thinking forward, and He says, you know, not everybody's going to do that. But the ones who receive that prophet, or the ones who take care of those who are teaching and preaching God's Word, the ones that receive them and help them and support them in that work, you know, like we support missionaries and we work with them to try to get the gospel out, we may never go to a foreign land and teach a lesson to somebody. But we can financially help support and become co-workers with them in that work. And so He says, anyone who helps support that is going to receive, if you help receive the prophet in the name of the prophet, you'll receive the prophet's reward. If you receive the righteous man in the name of the righteous man, you receive the righteous man's reward. So not everybody has to be on the front lines of the battle. I'm reminded of the time when David and his army were traveling to try to overtake an army that had captured a city and had spoiled the city and had taken off. And they were chasing after them. And some of the men were so exhausted that they couldn't go on. So they left some of the stuff, and they left some of the men there to guard that stuff because they were too tired to keep chasing the bad guys, you know. And so the rest of them went on, and they captured those guys. They won the battle, and they spoiled them and brought back their goods. When they got back, there were some of those men who were a little greedy. They said, you know what, these men that stayed here with the stuff, we'll give them their wives back. We'll let them have their wives. But all of the stuff, well, they didn't go to the battle with us, so we're going to split their stuff up and not let them have it. And David said, it's not going to work that way. No. If the people who stayed here and guarded the stuff, those people are going to get their share just like the ones that went to battle. That's significant for us, too. Not all of us are going to go to battle spiritually. Not all of us are going to go be missionaries and things. Not everybody's going to go to Bible school, preaching school, and do that. But we can still encourage them and support them and keep the stuff, guard the stuff while they're gone to do those things and help out in that way. And we can still receive the reward, just like the ones that were on the front lines. You know, in the army, everybody that participates in the war, they're victorious when the battle's won. They may have been the one that drove the supply truck, may have been the nurse, may have been the one that just did the paperwork, but when the army wins, they win. They're victorious. Even the people that stayed home and paid their taxes to pay those soldiers to go. Don't we say that? You know, who won World War II? Just the soldiers that went and fought? Well, no, certainly they did. But don't we say, we won World War II? We won it. We won that bat. We won. Now, we won. Some of us weren't even born yet. But we won. Because we take part in that. We need to have that same kind of camaraderie, that same kind of inclusive feeling toward the church. When there's something going on in the church, we are doing it. It's not, well, and I've heard people even say things like, well, what y'all are doing down there at the church? Well, wait a minute. If you're a member of the church, then it's what we are doing down at the church. It's what we as the church are doing, not what y'all are doing down there at your church. Or you hear somebody sometimes, well, I don't like what they're doing down there. Well, now, if you're not a part of the church, that's one thing. You know, I don't like what a lot of churches down there are doing at their churches. But when it comes to our congregation, what are we doing? We've got to be that unified force instead of trying to separate ourselves out and be like Eeyore and, oh, woe is me, I'm not part of it, nobody cares about me. We've got to all be part of this process. We've got to all be part of it as a group, as the church. And then in verse 42, he concludes this section by saying, even something as seemingly insignificant as giving a drink of water. He said, you do that, you won't lose your reward. The little things. You know, letting somebody share a meal with you. I remember, you know, children sometimes, little children, they're so generous, but they really don't have much to give. But I can remember times where little children in Bible class, you know, they wanted to help buy Bibles for the children in Africa or Russia or wherever. And so they'd bring their nickel to help buy Bibles. You know, it took a long time to save up enough nickels from those kids, you know, to buy one Bible for somebody. But the fact that they wanted to be helped, even that little, every little bit helped. We think about that widow's mite. Jesus said she gave more than everybody else because she was doing it out of a willing heart. She was doing it so generously, giving her all. Now, as we think about the end of this chapter, and before we go into chapter 11 next time, I want us to think about, there's some things that are kind of just skipped over a little bit in Matthew's account. Matthew never claims to put things in order. In fact, those who have studied it and tried to, you know, try to piece together, well, when did this happen and when did that? And certainly we're not going to get it perfect on that kind of thing. But as the 12 are now departing on their mission, their little limited commission that they're sent out on. This is about, give or take, about 5 weeks before the Passover in the second year of Jesus' ministry. So this would have been the second Passover of His ministry. And they're gone for about a month. And they come back in time for the Passover. John 6 and verse 4 will tell us about that. But then a little after that is when Christ feeds the 5,000. Luke 9, it shows us after that. Matthew doesn't have them in order. Matthew doesn't necessarily record it in chronological order. He just, a snapshot of this happens and that happens, and it's kind of pieced together. And it causes some confusion for us sometimes, because Matthew has this happening before that. And Mark has this happening before, and then Luke has this way, and we say, well, there's a contradiction in it, that because this one has this happening first, and the other one has the other thing happening first, and there's a problem. Of the Gospels, Luke is the only one who specifies that the way he wrote things down was the order they happened in. He says to Theophilus, I have set these things in order. And so if we ever wonder about, well, which came first, we want to look to Luke's account. Because he's the one that organized it in a chronological fashion. We think of things chronologically. When we're telling a story, that's the way we tell it. We tell it chronologically. The Jews didn't necessarily tell things chronologically like that all the time. And so Matthew and Mark and even John, and John's not even trying to deal with... John's trying to just show through the things that happened in Christ's life that He's God, that He is the Word. And so he's not even trying to put things in order. He's just maybe laying them out and putting, okay, here's this point that proves it, and here's this point that proves it, and he's just laying it out in that way. Now, he does generally, and all of them do generally, kind of follow the flow of Jesus' life from the beginning to His death and resurrection. But as far as the specific order of events, we need to not get confused. And it's easy to do, to get confused by, well, this one has this out of order. What order is it supposed to go in? If you're confused about that, go to Luke. Luke will help you. Dr. Luke was a very organized person, and he got things laid out in the chronological order, and that should help us. But what happens with Matthew here is, here at the end of chapter 10, the apostles are sent out. Chapter 11 details a few things that Jesus does. And then in chapter 12, he's just going to pick back up with the apostles being there. And you're like, wait a minute, when did they come back? And so we don't want to be confused by that. We want to keep that in mind. But there's a lot of things in here that even though Jesus was talking to his apostles almost 2,000 years ago, these things read like tomorrow's newspaper, don't they? He's hitting on things that are so practical for us and the way we live our lives. Who do we fear? Do we fear man or do we fear God? Who are we telling? Are we trying to keep Jesus a secret, or are we trying to tell everybody? What are we doing? Worried constantly about how we're going to take care of this and that and the other thing? Or do we trust that God's going to take care of it because He cares about us? Are we so worried about trying to be at peace with other people that we're sacrificing our peace with God? When Jesus said, hey, I'm going to bring a sword. I'm going to divide people. Even within their families. The people's family members are going to be their enemies. Wow, that's something to think about. People closest to you could be... Even blood isn't going to be able to overpower some people's hatred of the gospel. Even family relationships. Well, there's so many things there. But think about, what does God want us to do? How does Jesus want us to live our lives? Are we helping, supporting the spread of the gospel? We can take part in that. We can be co-workers, co-laborers, even though we may not go to that foreign field. Are we supporting it? Are we praying for those missionaries? Are we praying for the church in other places? Or do we have our mindset just on me and mine? Or do we have a world view of Christianity that we want everyone everywhere to receive the gospel and to have the opportunity to obey it? Tonight, if as a Christian, perhaps you hadn't been following some of these teachings that Jesus gives us here in Matthew 10. You need to make some corrections in your life. If so, please do so as we stand and as we sing.